about to enter into the longest running bull market of all time. This has been much anticipated. The bull tomorrow will turn 3,453 days old. I know that's kind of silly, but the old bull record was October 1990 into March 2000. That was almost 10 years. We're about to beat that. March 9th was the bottom, 2009. Remember that?
Let's start with Venezuela. Good. The banks there are closed today as the leadership tries another round of what they call economic reforms. Becky mentioned the massive devaluation. They're also going to introduce a new currency, which removes 50 from the biggest bill as the country suffers from hyperinflation, which some economists say is now worse than it ever was in the Weimar Republic.
Record day on Wall Street, NASDAQ, Russell, S&P. All-time highs. The Dow up nearly 170 points at the highs today, now up 134. That's 0.5%. All 11 of the S&P 500 sectors are higher. Which is the highest? Materials, technology, and energy in third place, as you see right there.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
U.S. stocks broke the record for the longest-running rally on Wednesday. The Russell 2000 has outrun the S&P 500 over the past 5 days, reaching a record closing high. And home sales in July fell for the second straight month, the longest slump since 2013. U.S.-China trade talks end with no sign of progress. And the S&P 500 is on track for its first record close since January. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Prytower, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava is on vacation and will be joining us when that vacation concludes. Joining me in hour one is Luis Yamada. She believes the inversion of the yield curve is not an immediate sign that the equities market advance is over. She believes technical indicators for U.S. equities do show negative indications, but overall, the monthly momentum looks good. She believes oil is in an uptrend and has good support at between $62 and $64, and she states that gold could sink to $1,150. She says that as long as the bull in the equities market continues, gold is, as she puts it, dead money. Now, in our interview with guest expert John Ng, also coming up in this portion of the Financial Sense News Hour, he has a very different assessment regarding gold. In that interview, he also believes that the president's tariffs could take us back to some of the devastating effects of the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930. He discusses some of the current inflationary impact that tariffs are making on steel, lumber, and housing starts. He believes tariffs are making, quote, a toxic inflationary impact, end quote. All of that coming up in hour one. Now, in the second hour, we will re-air our exclusive interview with Felix Zuloff. And when it comes to fund managers, Zuloff is a legend. So on hour two, he discusses China, a slowing world economy, a firm dollar, and he is bearish on gold, echoing Luis Yamada's comment that gold may continue to fall. Zuloff believes it may fall all the way back to 1050. Now, let's turn to Ryan Poplava for the weekly wrap-up report on the drivers and catalysts that moved the market this week. Ryan, what a stock market we've had this year. It's been a bumpy and volatile ride in 2018 with trade wars, currency devaluations, even budget uncertainty for some players with a 10% correction back in Q1.
Yeah, Chris, you had potentially all three this week. Last weekend, Venezuela devalued the Bolivar, and it's been the largest devaluation we've seen there, falling around 95%. Now, the reason it may not be as important to markets right now is that their external debt is only around $47 billion compared to Turkey at $467 billion. So recall the article you talked about last week about contagion spreading only for some countries and select situations. And if Turkey doesn't stabilize, it is possibly another Greek moment. But you're right. You know, the U.S. markets have been outperforming and the fundamentals continue to point to higher prices, as basically earnings and economic indicators continue to point towards growth.
Well, on that note, this Friday, coming off the end of a strong earnings season and economic data, the S&P 500 closed at a new 52-week high at, in fact, I've got the number written down here, it was 2874. Now, we've jokingly called this market the honey badger in the office. U.S. equities just don't care about the bad. And this week, we hit a record length for the bull market past over 3,400 days. In fact, it's exactly 3,453 days since the last 20% or more depression. The Russell 2000 has hit a new all-time high, and the NASDAQ composite closing at a new all-time high as well. Now, Ryan, I don't want to be a cheerleader yet because, well, you and Chris talked about the continued weakness that you've seen abroad for Chinese equities and emerging market equities. It has not been wise to own these areas in a portfolio through ETFs or mutual funds in the face of a rising dollar and the prospect of higher tariffs from the U.S. But I see with the weakness in the dollar this week, there's been a rally there. Has there been a change in any catalysts short term?
Well, you know, Chris, if we look at two other Republican predecessors to Trump, Reagan and Bush, they cut taxes that resulted in budget deficits. And in each case, there were rising interest rates at the directive of the Fed. That's where we're at right now. So I don't believe that's going to change. Now, the spread between our rates and those of other central banks will continue to widen as we continue to raise rates, likely next month, with a 90%+ chance of that happening, according to the federal funds futures. And until the ECB and others begin raising more meaningfully, which appears to be late next year, according to the minutes we saw this week from the ECB, the dollar may weaken short term. But, you know, as a result of mean reversion or technicals, like I mentioned in the big picture segment last week, maybe what we call a retest at the breakout, which is really just the last marker I look for a bottom. But I think the long term outlook is higher as long as we have a bullish equity market and interest rate differentials favoring investing in U.S. markets. That money flow is coming here, and that means more dollars that have to be purchased by these foreign investors.
Okay, so turning more to this week's news, we had the ECB minutes and the FOMC minutes, and then, of course, there's Jackson Hole. Now, I know Jim plans to spend a big chunk of his big picture when he comes back from vacation to really dig into the events this week there. But can you tell us what the consensus may be from all of the central bank speakers this week? And isn't it funny that we didn't get a major market correction while he was on vacation this month, like has usually been the norm? Don't the algorithms know better?
Yeah, I don't know if they have that in their programming, but, you know, don't jinx it. We still have a week left. So, Chris, there was a lot of Fed speak this week as Dallas Fed President Kaplan wrote an essay heading into that Wyoming Jackson Hole session between all the central banks. And that just kicked off recently. That's going to go into the weekend. But early in this week, he reiterated his opinion as well at Jackson Hole that he hopes yields can continue to move higher towards a more normal rate range around 2.75 before the curve inverts, with essentially a slightly dovish view that the long end of the curve is hinting at sluggish expectations for long-term growth. We actually got the flash PMI data this week, and we did see that the U.S. numbers came down. And Chris has been highlighting that he is seeing slower growth, not negative growth. We're not contracting, of course, with a GDP, with a four handle on the GDP. But Chris and I talked about that given that just the big flush of cash into the economy from the tax cuts, mainly that's going into stock buybacks, and that's not a long-term investment plan by corporations. Now, Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic is happy with the economy, and he focused on the yield curve this week, saying he's had extended conversations about it with his colleagues, essentially about a flattening yield curve. And he said very strong words, essentially pledging not to vote for anything that would knowingly invert the curve. But he did also say that many have confused correlation of the curve and a recession with causation. So he said, be careful about those too. Then there's the chairman himself, channeling his, what I think we'd call it, his inner Greenspan. Jerome Powell talked about how kind of insightful Greenspan was back in the 90s about how the economy was changing and some of those economic relationships that the central bank was following at the time, some of those relationships were breaking down. So he said that in his speech this week about Greenspan, and that essentially he feels some of that is happening now, and that that was basically the foundation for a slow and gradual approach to raising rates in the 90s, and essentially what it seems like he's trying to emulate and what Janet Yellen was emulating a couple years ago. My feeling is possibly it's because the Fed has usually overestimated how far to raise rates many times in the past. It's really hard to know where is that neutral normal rate. And when you are being aggressive at trying to rein in bubbles in the past, that was real estate for Bernanke and the tech bubble for Greenspan, it's hard to really gauge how far to keep raising it till you break it. And then when you break it, oh my God, we've had just crisis and recession after each situation. So it's best to just go slow. So Powell said it Friday, it's best to wait for clearer signs of inflation before getting really more aggressive.
Well, it's interesting your comment about the Atlanta Fed president with confusing correlation of the curve and a recession with causation. Just a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal, there's an article titled "The Myth of the All-Powerful Federal Reserve," and I would encourage our listeners to read that if they'd like to explore that controversy a little more. But Ryan, it will certainly be interesting to read between the lines with Jim on this in a couple of weeks. But Ryan, ending the wrap-up, can you target anything else that happened this week that was important for our listeners to follow?
Well, Chris, we're really getting pretty close to ending this second quarter earnings season. I think like 480-something companies have reported. Of those companies, I've looked and we've been something like 70, it was something like the 71%, 72% have beat on revenues. And that's among the highest we've seen in many, many quarters. But beyond that, just looking at some of the retail companies that are reported this week, yes, Amazon is the 800-pound gorilla that we should all worry about, but Walmart last week showed that if you take care of your employees, they had they initiated a program to do that back in 2015. The market penalized them for that. And if you have multi-channel sales, you know, they're showing, I think, 40% sales growth in their e-commerce. They're not earning a profit on that yet, but that's their strategy to make sure they don't lose to Amazon. You know, it's an unfortunately for them, it feels like a losing strategy, but no, on the long term, probably not. So Walmart has had a great long-term view. Beyond Walmart, look at TJX, which posted 16 consecutive quarters of increased customer traffic. Target and Lowe's also reported similarly very positive investor reactions this week to their earnings beats. And it was just a great week overall in U.S. equities with a nice drop in the dollar to kind of help emerging markets and Chinese markets rally to complement what we're seeing here in the U.S. But my advice is to watch the dollar very closely. We've come back down to support. We're at key support. If it rolls over, that was potentially a bullish pattern that has been negated. So if that's the case, that actually should be a good thing for emerging markets, for Chinese markets, and for us in the sense of we don't want to see the U.S. recouple. Now, the other area that saw some great performance in was the energy sector. It was the top performing sector this week, drawing on essentially the results from a drawdown in inventories that helped to calm investors over that huge build we got last week. And so oil was up nicely, and the S&P 500 energy sector was up 2.6%. after falling 3.6% last week. So that was good to see a bit of a rally there. Energy, very pro-cyclical. We saw a lot of other areas that were pro-cyclical do well this week. So that was good to see. And like I said, there was a plethora of retail names that reported. So overall, great week. You can't complain, right? The NASDAQ is at an all-time high. The Russell 2000 at an all-time high. S&P 500 at an all-time closing high. Now it's just the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's the last one that we need to see. And it would not surprise me if we do finally form a trade agreement with China. Negotiations really, there was an attempt this week, but I think both sides, Trump had nothing really to expect from it, and he had low expectations. China had some nice things to say, essentially that we're talking and both sides are taking things seriously. So at the next point where we'll actually get some real trade discussion really going forward will probably be next month. When we finally get an end to the comment period on the $200 billion, much bigger situation there and the 25% tariff.
Well, Ryan, since the last time we had you here in the studio, we've made history with the duration of this bull market. Hopefully, there'll be more good news to report upon your return. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Healthcare as we know it is going to absolutely disappear. We are on the cusp of really slowing down aging, improving health, predicting health risks, defining optimal treatment pathways, making doctors more efficient and more accurate. What's happening is that there is really a massive shift going on in this industry because of computing power and because of AI. And this computational power is really driving, it's the sort of the basis of the acceleration that we're seeing. And having the convergence of AI and robotics in healthcare is going to be an amazing thing to participate and watch.
He wrote the article Trains, Planes, and Dotcoms, detailing the euphoria in technology stocks and the bubble it represented 3 months before the peak in the NASDAQ. He wrote the article The Next Big Thing in April of 2002, pointing out the crossroads of a bear market fueled by monetary expansion, only to birth the next bull market in commodities. He wrote yet another prescient article in December of 2006 called The Next Rogue Wave, detailing the out-of-control credit expansion in developed economies a year before the global financial crisis began. You may know him from his weekly financial podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava has been educating the public on personal finances, investing, and the financial markets for over 30 years. He closed off his seminars to the public to focus only on his clients. Now, for the first time since the 90s, he is opening up his wealth of knowledge on the markets back to the public and invites you to a seminar, the Financial Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference, this October at the Hilton Del Mar. This is one seminar you won't want to miss. Call 888-486-3939 for more information or tune in now to his podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour, on iTunes and iHeartMedia to hear what he's saying now.
All right, I'd like to welcome our technician this week, Luis Yamada, founder of Luis Yamada Technical Research Advisors and the author of the monthly report Tech Points. She's regular on CNBC as well as Bloomberg when they call upon her to judge the trend of various investments and markets, and a familiar voice on Financial Sense the News Hour. Welcome, Luis.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So, Luis, I'd like to jump right into one of your recent calls on CNBC and Bloomberg, which is that gold could sink to 1,100. What is driving your call on the charts right now?
I love the way they grab the extremes, 1,100. Well, we've been suggesting that gold is in a rally in a bear market. The bear market started in 2011. It broke two-year support in 2013, and it has failed in all its rally attempts to get back up through 1400. So the breakthrough 1300 recently gave us targets at 1250 and 1200, which have already been achieved. But the monthly momentum model has gone to a sell. So that suggests that we have a little bit more risk on the downside, as in if gold continues below 1200, it could see 1150 or even 1100.
Oh, I see. So it's 1150 to
1150, 1100. Yeah, is the next stop.
Okay. And if I pull up a chart of gold here, I note that it seems to be rallying off the December 2016 low right around 1170. And it's had quite the rundown mm-hmm. from April when the dollar began to rise. There's been some dollar weakness over the past week. Dollar retests its breakout. Is this just what we'd call maybe a dead cat bounce for gold, in your opinion?
Well, I think considering that you're down from, 1364 to under 1200, you could have some kind of a rally, possibly toward the 200-day, which comes in around 1235. Not so sure it'll get up beyond 1250. But thereafter, we would anticipate selling into strength, and then we'll see a test again of 1200. And if it breaks, then the other targets would come into effect. After you've had such a decline, you're bound to get some kind of a kickback rally. And I think that the gold relationship to the dollar has been a lot less important historically than gold's relationship to the equity market, because the equity market has been outperforming. And whenever that has occurred, gold tends to underperform, which would mean either go up less or go down. And in this case, it's been going down. And as long as the bull market in equities continues, I think that gold is at risk or at least dead money.
And especially maybe with rising interest rates, gold doesn't pay any dividends.
Well, that's true.
Well, Luis, moving on to copper, yet another commodity that has been just correcting and almost in free fall recently, possibly as a result of maybe the rising dollar or maybe something more concerning over the world economy. Do you have any other concerns about other metals besides gold?
Well, copper's been on our sell alert here for a while. It's been looking weak. It's also had a monthly momentum sell. And I don't know, they related a lot to the Chinese economy, but we have to remember that China really stockpiled copper for years. And maybe instead of buying in the open market at this point, it's using some of its own reserves. I think that overall, the commodities have been doing poorly. And again, that may well be because the equity market is doing well.
Well, there's one commodity you've been bullish on. Going back to a review you did, a TV interview in May, it looks like you have had a bullish call for oil, and it's been fairly volatile since. And recently, India has announced its plans to cut back on oil from Iran. What's your view? If it jumps back above the 50-day moving average here on Friday, are we in a trading range or will prices break out of this soon in either direction?
Well, you've had an interesting profile on oil since 2016, where each pullback has held at a slightly higher low. So that defines an uptrend, clearly. And we had targets to 78.80, and we're in that vicinity. I think you have good support here around $64, $62, $62 to $64. And at the moment, there isn't anything to suggest to us that it's going to reverse unless it comes under that support.
Okay.
And it's interesting because this is the one commodity that's been doing better, irrelevant of what the dollar's doing. So there are a lot of intermarket relationships that have been a little flaky over the last several years.
That is a very interesting judgment call, and I completely agree with you. And recently, Luis, yet another commodity I've been very interested in is looking at agricultural prices, especially for some of my holdings. I've been looking and following potash prices. Have you been following any other charts besides the metals and energy? Have you been looking at agriculture? Is there anything there that we should be looking at?
We have not looked at individual agricultural prices in quite a while, actually. I mean, the overall ETF for agriculture, the DBA, has been in a downtrend. So unless there's something in specific that you wanted to look at, I have not really been following them because they've been sort of following the metal complex in a downtrend.
I guess there's one commodity in particular some of our listeners might really enjoy. That's coffee, which has been in a downtrend. But I guess if we go to Starbucks, we might not see a price decrease there.
I don't think they're ready to decrease prices at Starbucks ever.
maybe too much strong demand.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's turn away from commodities. I think we pretty much covered quite a few of the softs, energy and agriculture, and I appreciate your views there. And it seems like there's clearly a theme, a downtrend in most commodities. Oil's the only one that might be interesting on the upside. Well, I'd like to turn now to U.S. equities and looking at the U.S. market, which has been really what we've called the best house in a bad global neighborhood. It seems like the U.S. stock market is just impenetrable, Luis. It's brushing off its shoulder of every political, trade-related, currency-related disturbance that deserves a headline. And we got all three this week. I would say this is still not the strongest bull market measured by returns. I think you wrote about it in your book, Magic Market. That was the dot-com bull market from 1990 to March 2000. It's the longest now in number of days, and we're still tacking on days. How much longer do you think this bull market can go until maybe we see a serious correction?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure we're in a position at the moment to answer it. We've been cautious for several months until we got the collapse in January and then sort of a test of the low in March. The technical indicators do have negative divergences in place in terms of new highs versus new lows, in terms of the volume momentum that we follow, which measures up versus down volume. None of them are negative, but they have been failing at lower highs throughout this little retreat in the market and recovery, so to speak. So for the S&P as an example, you're back up near the January peak, but you've got some technical indicators that are still questionable. On the other hand, the monthly momentum, which is a more structural measure, where they began to look like they were going to register sell signals, have pulled back from that precipice and are actually positive again, or I should say remained positive rather than giving the sell signal. So we're in a situation where I think the market remains very selective and you have to be careful where you're picking. Technology has been a leader. Some of them have suffered somewhat. I wouldn't say they look like major tops, but you've certainly had corrections in some of the names, and maybe those corrections are over. We will have to wait and see. I think that there is more to go in the market at this point, but we're still very cautious and very selective.
Yeah, I think last we had you on the show in April, you didn't think at that time we would reach new highs. And so far, that's been the case. So a great call there. And it seems like you're still a little bit unsure of whether we're going to reach those new prices because of all those divergences you're noticing.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, if we do burst out to new highs, you're close on the S&P today. If we do burst out on new highs, you might have a lot of short covering, which pushes the market a little higher temporarily. But what we want to see is whether that breakout, as and if it occurs, is sustainable. And I think that's the most important aspect. The other thing that we're looking for is the broadening out of the equity market. And you may be getting some interest here in healthcare, which was starting to look a little better when we last published. But the surprises of the pharmaceuticals that have done quite well, having, you know, not been looking relatively strong, they're starting to do all right. So if we get more participation, and you're not getting it so much in materials or industrials, a little bit in the industrials, and the financials has been somewhat disappointing. It's very selective there too. So I think you really have to pick and choose.
I completely agree, Luis. In fact, you went right into where I wanted to go next, and that's looking at the sectors. So thank you for that view. And we've noticed some clear rotation out of semiconductors into some of those non-cyclical sectors. You mentioned healthcare among some. We've seen staples improving. We've seen telecom and utilities improving. And those are typically defensive sectors. Am I right?
They are defensive sectors. You've got the real estate investment trust. That new little group has been looking a little bit better. The utilities are looking better on a relative basis, but it's really more of a flat trading range for the year. You haven't seen the relative drop to new lows. It's just been sort of vacillating, and the price hasn't gone to new highs. I think, obviously, the information technology has continued to move to new highs. Materials has had a very difficult time and a declining relative strength, so I would stay out of that completely. Healthcare may be just trying to get through its relative downtrend, but financials continue to roll over. Very, very intriguing. And of course, consumer discretionary had a period here where it underperformed, although it had been in an uptrend, starting to look a little better and making a new high. But recognize that MSCI is changing all of these sector compositions. So consumer discretionary, which has been very strong, is losing some of its big names, primarily technology, toward the end of September, which is, I think, important for people to recognize, and moving some of them into a new communications group. So the telecommunications group is going to switch into a communications group, and it's going to have names like Google, I think, is going into it, Facebook. I'm just looking quickly here to see what else might be going into it. But so a lot of the relative strength that's in place today is going to be shifting as we get into the end of September. And I think clients should be aware of that.
That's a really important point, Luis, especially since some of those holdings are part of the FANG complex that have been just
exactly. Big
momentum drivers. That's very interesting.
Right.
If we looked even more narrow in scope into some of the select industry groups, is there anything out there? I mentioned the semiconductors. Is there anything out mm-hmm. there of interest to you in your technical work?
Well, very difficult to, it's a hard question to ask. I mean, I think that the healthcare is where we're looking right now to see where some leadership can come into place. But the interesting thing is that technology itself may be starting to turn around some of those semiconductor names. Let's see what happened today. I'm just in front of the Bloomberg machine. What's happening to NVIDIA is at a new high. It started to look like it was rolling over, and here it is initiating another uptrend. So I think that these could have been temporary consolidation setbacks, if you will. And a lot of the large names in individual countries like Taiwan, a semiconductor, Taiwan Semiconductor is a large, large weight in that group. And it may be trying to stabilize, but maybe part of why that country hasn't been looking too chipper. A lot of the emerging market nations have been suffering a little, and maybe because they have these large technology names that really dominate. If they start to turn around, then maybe we see a little improvement in those countries.
Well, I'm glad you went there, because that's actually where I want to go next. I want to start taking a look at some of the global markets. We just finished talking about the U.S. market. So one of the things my brother and I have been focusing is on our analysis of the weakness in global equities, ex the U.S. And since 2009, we've seen the U.S. avoid global weakness only to recouple a few months or more down the road. Do you think this time may be different? Will the U.S. recouple, or will it continue to brush its shoulder off of maybe global slowdown concerns?
Well, the U.S. has been outperforming the world for quite a long time, really since the beginning of since 2009, since the bull market began off the major decline. We've had a couple of minor setbacks, but basically the uptrend is intact and remains intact. The emerging market ETF, if we look at the EEM, has broken down, breaking uptrends and going on monthly momentum sales. And the same thing for the EAFE. The EFA is the symbol for the ETF. It's also been looking weak. So the U.S. stands out as the place to be until further notice.
It appears that over the short term, we've seen a rally in these areas in emerging markets and in the Chinese Shanghai composite. Mm-hmm. Is this just a rally in an ongoing correction, or do you think the correction is maybe overdone, possibly still yet more to come on the downside?
Well, Shanghai really has had quite a decline since the early part of the this year. And I think it's going to take some time to recover from that. Hang Seng, which also has had, my goodness, quite a decline, and that's on a monthly sell. I think it's going to take time and sideways price action to suggest that we're seeing consolidation rather than the potential for further underperformance.
Yeah, and I guess if we're still looking at emerging markets, we've seen just India maybe being that one bright spot in that sea of trouble out there.
I was just going to suggest that it is. It's been a stellar outperformer.
It has. And on the flip side, you mentioned the Hang Seng. Looking at the Japanese topics, it's what appears to be a very critical support. If it doesn't hold here, we could be looking at a possible bear market. What are your thoughts there on Japan?
Well, the topics is heavy weighted in financials, and that's where we're seeing, at least in the U.S. market, some weakness. I think the Nikkei is the one that we watch more regularly, and that's still in a nice uptrend from 2016, doing a little consolidating here. So it's got quite a bit more leeway to go before a support break might be forthcoming than for the topic.
So primarily what you're saying is the weakness in financials is what's driving that in the topics, and that's a great point.
Yeah.
If we're dealing with financials, is it the yield curve that's really upsetting investors there? What are your thoughts there as we turn to looking at bonds and interest rates?
Well, you are probably aware that we think we're in a transition from a 36, 37-year falling rate cycle into a new rising rate cycle, which most young traders have never experienced since the falling rate cycle was 36 years. I think it's important to note that transitions from falling rates to rising rates have take a long time. This one's been 6 to 8 years, primarily because it's battling deflationary pressures. And I think we're at the 3% threshold on the 10-year. We have suggested that we have seen the turn. And it's just a question of time before we get through 3%. I don't think rates are going to rise at a rapid rate at all. I think that technology continues to exert a certain degree of deflationary pressures on the economy because it's so efficient, and we're moving into, you know, robotics, even in industrial areas, robotics, which are not inflationary. And I think that we should recognize that rates are probably on the rise, but I think it'll be a very slow move in the early portion of it. Although tariffs don't help, because tariffs, ultimately, the cost of the tariffs is borne by the consumer, and that will start raising prices and possibly impact the inflation, which unfortunately is not really seen anymore in the capital goods arena. You're seeing it in what I've called for years consumer essentials. You're seeing it in healthcare, you're seeing it in education, you're seeing it in food, you're seeing it in everything that the consumer needs, and that can be problematic over time. But not right now. And I think the other thing to recognize with all the talk about the inversion of the yield curve, if it should happen, is not an immediate sign that the equity market advance is over. When it has happened and resulted in a bear market, it's been a long time after the inversion that the equity market generally gives up.
Yeah, I think in some of our studies of that inversion, it's been somewhere between 3 and 6 months, sometimes a year out after the inversion.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm glad you hit on that, because we were just looking at 2 to 10 year spreads, and they continue to narrow. Just this week, we hit, I think, 21 between the 2 year treasury and the 10 year treasury. And that's actually below for Japan. Japan's is at 22 basis points.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's the first time we've seen that since 2007.
Well, and I think that people should recognize that if you get any rallies in the bond market, which would bring the yields down a little, that's a good time to eliminate some of your longer term positions and move into the shorter term, whether it's a 6 month, a 1 year, or a 2 year, because then as rates go up, you can rotate into the higher rates year after year, which I think is important. And 2% is very nice at this point compared to what we've had as negative interest rates for so long that people at some point might, especially retirees, consider taking some money out of the risky stock market and putting it into a 1 or 2 year note at 2%.
We've seen that as well, and that may be why there's just so much demand on the short end of the curve driving those interest rates. And so it looks like we've pretty much covered the bond market, the stock market, both globally in the U.S. as well as commodities. Luis, is there any other area that you talked a little bit about a strategic move you can make right now with interest rates going up? If there is a rally in bonds, use that opportunity to rotate your portfolio. What other portfolio recommendations would you be making now from an asset class standpoint or something more narrow?
I think that's, in my mind, the most important at this point in time, especially for older retirees, because you know they don't have as much time as the younger ones, and I think it's silly to be caught in a 10-year note at 2% if rates continue to climb. Not to mention the 30-year, if anybody's way out in the 30-year at very low interest rates, when over the next few decades rates are inevitably going to lift.
Yeah, especially on the short end, if we have a very aggressive Fed now moving from 3 rate hikes down to up to 4.
I think they're trying to normalize the interest rate environment to a certain extent. I mean, considering that it was excessively low, I think it's probably a wise move.
Especially if we have some weakness down the road where they can essentially lower those rates.
Exactly.
Well, Luis, thank you so much for, again, being on our show and for our listeners. But to conclude, is there anything else, I guess, with some of your technical work? Is there some place our listeners can go to take a look at more of what you're doing? I know you do a monthly newsletter. Is there anywhere investors can go to learn more about that?
Yes, you can go to the website, my website, just Google my name, and you will see an info@LYAdvisors email, and you can send me an email. And we can give you information on the subscription, and happy to send a sample. Plus, whatever occurs in public relations is usually posted on our website so people can stay abreast of our thinking.
Well, thank you so much, Louise. It's always great to hear from you, an amazing voice and talent in technical analysis. Really appreciate the opportunity.
You're very kind. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This bull market, which began by all accounts in March of 2009, coming in over 9 years, I believe has room to run for a number of reasons, not the least of which is because if we look at the long-term scheme of things, as far as a continued onward stretch of expansion, we could go back and see that there were technically longer bull markets in the stock market, like for instance, 1942 to 1957, 15 years, or 1987 to 2000, 13 years, depending on how exactly you want to define it.
President Trump would do well to learn from history, particularly when we look at the 30s, given that we now have overvalued markets, an escalating trade war, and excessive borrowing. It is not so different this time, so writes John Ng, president and CEO at Maison Plasmance in Canada. And John, I want to note your recent report was very interesting. We're going to have a link out to it where this interview is located on Financial Sense if any of our listeners would like to read it. It's titled The Bull in the China Shop. And you have a very humorous graphic here where Trump is essentially a bull entering into a China shop with lots of fragile stuff around. And he's got a big smile on his face here, we should note. So let's talk about basically the thing that you start off talking about here in your piece, which is the fact that people may be underestimating the tariff situation. And it sounds like you're saying that you think there's a possibility we may be looking at something even similar to what we saw in the 30s. So let's get into that. How severe of a tariff threat to the global economy are we looking at?
Well, Chris, it's very, very interesting. I've done a fair amount of homework and study, and the view in the White House is that the tariffs are winnable and they're Trump's way to change the world order, notwithstanding the fact that the $500 billion deficit represents something in less than 3% of your GDP. But nonetheless, his belief is that he can extract change by imposing these tariffs. So a view through history is that, in fact, in the 80s, there was a protectionist push against Japan. Japan was thought to be the big behemoth, the big gorilla. And so President Bush imposed tariffs on Japan. But within less than a year, he reversed himself when the impact was really on the consumers. And there was almost a rebellion. And then going so tariffs are nothing new for presidents. It's just that the one that really comes to fore was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in June of 1930. And that turned out to be initially very benign. It was a 20% to 44% tariff on something like 900 goods. And even then, Hoover thought that bringing in the tariffs would be a way to bring jobs back home, would stop imports, and would get the economy going. Well, within 30 days, there was retaliation by something like 30-odd countries, Canada included, slapped tariffs. And as we saw, exports, in fact, between 1929 and 1933, they fell by 50%. And in fact, the value fell by 2/3. And so that helped accelerate the depression into the Great Depression. The other point I would make was that the tariffs are truly like a tax. And in this instance, we have seen already the impact on steel, for example, which is up by 40-odd%. Lumber, the softwood lumber producers, almost a year ago were slapped with a tariff, Canadian lumber, and we saw the impact on housing starts. Housing starts are down. So there's unquestionably there's an impact on the economy, and I believe the impact will be inflationary. And that comes at a time when the core rate of inflation is growing, not going down like it used to. And then we have the retaliation on food. The Chinese particularly have retaliated on soybeans. And this comes at a time when stockpiles are low. And your producer price index has actually gone up to a 6.5-year high. And the fear that I have is that if you superimpose energy prices, and I think that the sanctions on Iran touched off a boom in oil prices, and this is a toxic combination for more inflation. And that's something that the markets are not prepared. The markets, as we know, Chris, is priced to perfection. And in fact, we're just enjoying the longest bull market in history. And that's all of the past, and then because we've had quantitative easing, better growth. But in the future now, I think we're going to see the consequences of the tariffs, of the sanction, and of more inflation.
Well, it's interesting, John, because on the day that you and I are speaking, it's August 23rd on Thursday. And just today, a headline saying that the U.S. and China have now slapped a bunch of tariffs on each other again, and their first talks in months went nowhere. So it doesn't look like the situation is improving at this point. It actually looks like it's deteriorating. And many believe that it's going to continue to deteriorate at least until we get to the November elections, at which point perhaps Trump is hoping that he can secure a deal and look good before, you know, we see those November midterm elections. But, I don't know if that's increasingly becoming just a hope, an unrealistic hope, really.
Well, the Canada itself is a recipient of Trump's tariffs, and it's having an impact. But when you look at China, the view is that the White House views that America buys four times more from China, and therefore they have most to lose. But you must remember that your economy is built on consumerism, whereas China really are self-sufficient. They are not yet at that stage. And so with your economy built on consumerism, there's no question in my mind that iPhones will be more expensive, flat screen TVs, food, Mercedes will be expensive, to the point where now farmers are beginning to scream. And that's, of course, part of the base of Mr. Trump. And he has dusted off something like the Community Credit Corporation in order to bail out the farmers to, I think it's $16 billion, which is not very much. But nonetheless, if you look at the genesis or the beginning of this credit corporation, that was in 1933, and that was to bail out the farmers during the Dirty 30s, during the Great Depression. The other factor at work, and I'm just doing some work, was climate change in the 30s also had an impact on the economy. And that helped speed up the Great Depression, where we had your five states, Texas included, and you had these big dust bowls and the migration to California. Well, you know, today we have climate change, and you have the Midwest that just experiencing drought, and farm techniques are much more sophisticated. But we have seen the impact on food prices, and this comes at a time when we are ill prepared to put a tax on that. We should be encouraging lower prices because all the other prices are going up. China has, the other point I guess I'd make is China has a lot of tools in its arsenal. For example, we saw that when it put the kibosh on the Qualcomm's $44 billion bid, which would have helped Qualcomm, a U.S. company, grow. And that is another casualties of these tariffs. The other point is that China itself has put a stop or tightened regulation on waste paper and recycling, to the point where now there is on the ports, there's particularly in Canada too, the recycling programs, which are built on China being the big buyer of these recyclers, that's backed up now. And this is the backbone of a lot of the economy's recycling programs. If the Chinese don't buy, who is going to buy? So China has many, many tools in its arsenal. And of course, the biggest one, and we're beginning to see this now, is the currency. And my point is that these tariffs have really gone into morphing into a currency war. And then, of course, in the Great Depression, we saw competitive devaluations. Now, the Chinese yuan has dropped 10% since April. And, of course, that gives them some sort of competitive advantage. But it's not only that currency that has gone down with the American dollar being super strong. And my point is that with the currency upheaval and the expectation of currency competitive devaluations, that in itself is potentially inflationary. We see, for example, in Turkey, where the lira has gone down by 50-odd percent, and that has sparked a crisis in the emerging markets. That the point that I would make is that in local currencies like the Turkish lira, gold has actually performed its hedging role, because in terms of in gold expressed in lira has gone up 55%. In fact, South African rand, which has been going down, in South African rand, gold has gone up 6%. In the Russian ruble, gold has gone up 8%. So gold has served out to be a hedge. So we in North America are saying, oh, gold is a dud. Well, no, gold is performing as a hedge. My expectation is that we're enjoying record markets because of this boom. But if we, that's history. If we look in the future, we've got tariffs, we've got currency depreciation, and all these ingredients to me add up that gold will raise its head again. And the final point I would make is, as we know, when Trump introduced that $1 trillion tax cut, it piled on more debt onto your debt, which is now in excess of $21 trillion. Well, who finances that? A large part was the Chinese, Japanese, and now with these trade tariffs, with sanctions, etc., that is going to become problematic. And already we've seen Japanese yen holdings, Japanese holdings of American debt are at lows of 2011. The Chinese have not purchased treasuries for the last 4 months. And in fact, what they are buying is gold. The Russians, too, are buying gold. They bought something like 25 tons last month, and they now hold more than 2,000 tons, and they have become the fifth largest holder. So I think what's at work is that with these tariffs and kicking sand in the face of allies is causing others to look at their the financial hegemony of America, and gold is an alternative.
Now, gold has definitely not done well if you look at it priced in U.S. dollars for this year so far. It's at multi-year lows, so it's reversed a lot of the gains that it's seen so far. And a lot of people are tying that back to the strength of the dollar. So I guess, you know, if you look at that inverse correlation between the two, if the dollar were to continue to strengthen from these levels, then that would be negative for gold. We've seen some weakness in the dollar since it peaked about a week or two ago. Some believe that the strength of the dollar might now actually be over. You know, it's hard to say exactly. We do see that the Fed is continuing to raise interest rates. And a large part of that is tied to inflationary pressures and differentials with other countries. But do you have any thoughts on the trajectory of the U.S. dollar and how that's tied to the performance of gold going forward?
Well, I think that the U.S. dollar has the correlation with gold is there's an acute negative correlation. My sense is that just as the benefit of quantitative easing the economy has grown, inflation has been subdued. All those were ingredients for a strong U.S. dollar. But I believe that the fundamentals are eroding behind under the U.S. dollar and being undermined by things like the sanctions, things like the tariffs, and definitely more inflation. Inflation is something that, in fact, markets are not talking about, but we've seen an increase in the core rate of inflation when that happens, that removes the props from under the dollar. The dollar flirted with a DXY with 92. It's gone up about 3.7% year to date, whereas gold has gone down. But my belief is that going into the fall, we will see a steady erosion of the dollar, A, because of lack of purchases and selling from other countries. B is, you, of course, you have your midterms coming up, the uncertainties of that. And C is this tariff escalation, war escalation. It just doesn't seem to want to end. And that is bodes not well for the U.S. dollar. So we have seen periods where 75, multiple periods where the U.S. dollar has come under pressure. And I think that 92 level on the DXY is a key level. So my view is that it's been in a trading range. 96 is the high, 92 would be the low. Breaks 92, then that will be the catalyst for gold.
Well, gold is definitely getting a lift with some of the weakness that we have seen in the dollar for the past couple of weeks or so. So I think a lot of strategists are keeping a close eye on where the dollar's heading from here. And not just for gold's sake. I mean, also when we think about oil, when we think about commodities and its effect on the wider emerging markets as well. So a lot of things are tied back to the dollar, and it seems like it's an important thing to be watching now. John, I want to thank you for coming onto our show and giving your outlook on your recent piece. It is located on financialsense.com. If anyone would like to read it, the title is The Bull in the China Shop. And with that said, we always enjoy having you on our show. We look forward to speaking to you again on Financial Sense News Hour.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on this portion of the Financial Sense News Hour. Stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture. We're going to re-air our exclusive interview with legendary fund manager Felix Zuloff. This happened back in June on the FS Insider, and that's where Zuloff provided a comprehensive overview of the current macro outlook. He discussed a number of large topics like China, President Trump, even the current trade war, and he goes into some detail on U.S. dollar, gold, bonds, commodities, and more. So be sure to stay tuned for the second hour with Felix Zuloff.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.